to be talking about Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh is the first mitzvah that we were given as a group. So before Rosh Chodesh was given, and I'll explain soon exactly what it is. Actually, let me interrupt. The shir is Le'ilui Nishmat V'Chalei Bas Rav Chaim Tzvi. Okay, before we talk about what Rosh Chodesh is, we have to talk about what mitzvot are for and the difference between a mitzvah given to an individual and a mitzvah given to a group. The very first statement the Torah makes, as we know, is Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve'et ha-aretz. In the beginning, Hashem created the heavens and the earth. One of the strangest questions I've ever heard is Rashi's question. He says, why does the Torah begin at the beginning? Now, as soon as I heard the question, never mind the answer, I was thinking, this is a whole other way to think. Why does something begin at the beginning? Why shouldn't something begin at the beginning? And Rashi goes on and explains himself, and he says that the Torah should have begun with the mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh, because it was the first mitzvah that the Jews were commanded. So what that tells us is that the Torah isn't meant to unfold the world for us. That's not what the Torah is meant to do. The world is the outcome, and the Torah is the blueprint. The word Torah comes from the word hora'ah, which means instruction. So the Torah is meant to instruct us on how to interpret the world. So, of course, Rashi's point is very well taken. It shouldn't begin by talking about the world. We see the world. But it should be talking about how we should relate to the world. And in fact, Ramban takes up Rashi's question and points out that, yes, the reason why it begins at this point is because the stories in the Torah are instructive, not about the world itself, but about our relationship to it. That we learn something from Adam, Chava, Noach, all of the patriarchs and matriarchs, which is how to relate to God and how not to relate to God. So the question still remains a classical and perfect and beautifully elegant question, which is, why should the Torah begin at the beginning when it could have begun with instruction in its purest sense? So a question that people ask is sometimes, why do we need instructions? A 21st century person will say, my instructions lie within me. Why do we need instructions? So the Jewish view is that the instructions precede the world, that the world follows a blueprint, and the instructions are in fact a description of what the world is for. So let me give you an example of what I mean. If you just came, OTB, as we say in Brooklyn when describing people who are off the boat, if you just came OTB, and you come to someone's home and you see a computer, the first thing that you would ask if you're an intelligent person is, what is it and what is it for? Not just what is it, the answer, a computer isn't going to do it for you. What is it for? So the person who may or may not know how a computer works, a lot of people know how to work a computer but don't know how a computer works, like me for instance, will tell you what it does. So the person really isn't answering your question. You're asking what is it and what's it for. They're answering what is it called, not what is it, and how do I work it. But they haven't told you what it's for. So similarly, through human observation, we could give things names, we could call things whatever we call them. Doesn't mean we know what it is. We could figure out the workings of things. Doesn't mean we know what they're for. So we end up groping. We end up groping the same way somebody who could use a name to describe a computer but really has no idea of what a computer is and could make it work but really has no idea of what the mechanical mind is for and what it isn't, really can't approach anything with much depth. The purpose of the Torah isn't to tell us the names of things, it's to tell us what things are. It's not to tell us how to use them, but to tell us what it's for. So the reason why we need something beyond our scope, why we don't say the answers are all inside, is because we're so limited. We're limited far more than my OTB person that I just described. The OTB person came from another society in which all of the assumptions were different. We come from a different plane than the Creator does. We come from the plane of observing things through our senses, which are very, very limited in terms of what they could observe. So the Torah is meant to take us a step beyond our senses. Now let's talk about mitzvot. We said that the instructions aren't just statements, but they're mitzvot, which is an interesting idea. So I want to talk about the difference between enlightenment and commandment, vis-a-vis what the world is and what it's for. In other religions, and certainly in Western thought, enlightenment is a goal in itself. So, I am what I know, I am what I think, is something that people say with what has become a very credible sort of a motto, which it doesn't have to be, but whatever. That's a terrible sentence, by the way. We wouldn't say that. We don't believe that enlightenment is an end. And I want to tell you why. Enlightenment just tells you more clearly what its name is and how it works. It still doesn't tell you what it is and what it's for, unless you include something beyond yourself, beyond the vision of the senses. So I'll give you an example using psychology. Freudian analysis is pretty discredited at this point. But the theory was that if you could take somebody far back enough into their past, to the point where they know the moment of their conflict, the moment where they had to repress something that was real in them and cover it up with all sorts of layers, if they could do that, then they could tear aside all the layers, get to know the real self, and live happily ever after. The reason why Freudian theory is pretty well discredited at this point and has been replaced by other forms of therapy is that people discovered after many years of analysis, there have been people who've been in analysis 15 years, that yes, they know themselves better, but they still don't know what it's for. They still don't know much more than to describe the person they are. There's no direction, which is a terrible human tragedy, by the way. We work on the premise that there's a path and that the path has an end. The end is closeness to God. So if we were to compare, let's say, Rambam's middle path to Aristotle's middle path, they use the same vocabulary, they read the same books, the golden mean. We would say that by looking at anything and questioning what it's there for, we could avoid extremity. For instance, anger is there to affect change. So too much anger will cause defensiveness and will not bring about change. Too little anger will create passivity and almost an apathy, won't cause change. The middle road would be expressing enough protest without losing oneself in passionate anger. Going back a moment, we would say that for a person to be able to answer, but what am I for and where am I going, requires a path that goes beyond human consciousness. So we were talking about how Aristotle's path would be different than that of Rambam. They both talk about the middle path, meaning any trait has to be used for its purpose. Too much is defeating, and too little is defeating. So, for instance, with anger, too little anger is apathy. Too much anger creates defense and means that whatever it is you seek to change won't happen. So any amount of passionate anger will create defense, and therefore Rambam will come out to a place where expressed anger as opposed to passionate anger is the middle path. And Aristotle is on the same wavelength. The difference is that Rambam will say, and if you walk on this path, it takes you somewhere. It's called Derech Hashem. It takes you to what he calls, quoting Tehillim, Har Hashem. He says, this is the path of Avraham. This is the path in which you change yourself and by effect change the world. And it connects you to its author and its master. While Aristotle would have said, and then you'll be happy. Then you'll be enlightened. There's no end. There's no purpose. And I'll tell you why he also didn't know what things were for. So everything is here to give us the ability to make real connection and to uplift who we are and what the world is. To use the Vilna Gaon's words, we're here for tikkun atzmi and tikkun olam. So from that perspective, mitzvot are enormously important. The reason why mitzvot are enormously important is Hashem purposely created us with a huge empty place. Filling that empty place constructively and meaningfully is what life is about. This is what mitzvot do. This is what Torah does. So experiencing the emptiness of just being and saying, and I'll fill it with meaning and direction, is hugely significant. So what the mitzvot do is give us a way in which we could achieve that end without leaving our bodies behind or our emotions behind or our mind behind. So there are mitzvot that affect us physically, mitzvot that affect us emotionally, mitzvot that we do through the mind, but we don't leave any part of ourselves behind. Similarly, with the world, when we observe mitzvot, we don't leave the world behind. We don't try to abandon the world or disregard the world. It's not what it is at all. We try to uplift the world and integrate the world. So with that in mind, we could say that the first instruction of the Torah has to be a mitzvah, and it'll have to be a mitzvah that changes us and changes the world. Now, there were mitzvot that were given to individuals. Somehow, we're not even counting that. Notice what Rashi says. The Torah should have begun with the mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh, the new moon, because it's the first mitzvah that was given to the Jews collectively. So the question would be, why would any individual be given a mitzvah? And why don't these mitzvot somehow count? So let's talk about the history of individual mitzvot up to the point of the Jews being given the mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh. So we have this, that Adam was born knowing. He had a strong sense of who he is and what the world is for and what he's for. Even his sin was coming without having lost that perspective. So he came equipped with the knowledge of seven mitzvot. They were as much part of him as respiration or digestion, and they were reiterated to us by way of hint in Hashem's interaction with him. So these mitzvot were the basis of human society. We can only talk about the generation of the flood being wicked and being perverse if there are rules to the game. So people understood the rules. Okay, moving on. You have the people of Sodom, being described as ra'im v'chata'im, being evil and sinful. There were rules to the game. There was no Torah, but there were rules to the game. These rules came from the inside, but also from the outside. Remember, they were engraved upon Adam's heart, but also stated to him, as it's hinted to us at the end of Parshas Bereishis. So he knew from an objective point, not just his own subjective take on life. And this is what was passed on to others. Suddenly, we have Avraham on the scene and a whole new reality. God's telling an individual what to do, and not just in terms of instructions having to do with his own private life for a given amount of time, like leave where you were and move to Israel, but things that he's meant to pass down. So let's look at the classical mitzvah, Brit Milah. Now, if I thought the Torah had to begin with the mitzvah, I wouldn't have asked Rashi's question, which is one of the reasons I'm me and he's Rashi. I would have said, the Torah should have begun with Brit Milah. What was Brit Milah about? was everything we said a mitzvah should be. It takes you beyond the rational self. None of us would have dreamt of Brit Milah. Okay, it uplifts the physical. It is something that requires effort and self-change. It uplifts the person who does it. It's a beautiful mitzvah. But it affected one person and the people who were close to him. So, in order to understand why that's a significant statement, we have to talk about the way Hashem sees us and the way we see ourselves. I'm going to give you an example. Parents often worry about whether they're giving their children enough attention. If you were to ask your average six-year-old, not a six-year-old coming from a marvelous home, but not a six-year-old coming from an abusive home either, what would you rather have, your own room or a baby, or mommy to have a baby? In my observation, the six-year-old wants a baby. And if you could say, what do you want mommy to have, one baby or twins? What do they want? Twins. Twins or triplets? Triplets. Now, of course, they're 6 years old. They don't take care of them. They don't take responsibility for them. But what I want to say is that a six-year-old has a certain purity of vision that we sometimes lose. They see the beauty of another human being. Yeah, a baby, a person, a little person. Somebody who does things. That doesn't mean, again, that they want to take care of them or that they want to take responsibility for them. But they certainly see something beautiful about another person. Oftentimes we lose it. We lose our sense of beauty. We're so involved in seeing people as needy and seeing people as broken that we sometimes lose track of their incredible, incredible beauty. To the point that for most of us, a city, by definition, isn't such an attractive place. So Hashem's view is very different. He saw human beings as beautiful. And his goal was to have mitzvot not just for a specific and defined unique individual, but for a people. Because the people could affect the world with far more credibility than an individual can. So what this means is, bottom line, Brit Milah didn't count. Didn't count as first mitzvah that was given to a group. For that, we need Rosh Chodesh. So at this point, we have to talk about Rosh Chodesh, talk about life in Egypt, and talk about why this mitzvah was so necessary at that time. Okay, we divide, as you know, we divide time by years, months, days, and particles of days. Why do we talk about time? What's time all about? So when you ask somebody, what is time? They usually get very flustered. They could tell you how to measure time, months, days, years. But what is it? It's harder to zero in on. So a physical definition of time has to do with rotations and revolutions, the way the earth revolves around the sun and the way it rotates from one end to the other on its 24-hour cycle. So a day comes from the earth's movement and a year comes from the earth's rotation around the sun. So what we're really talking about is movement. We're not talking about time. So what we're saying then is that time is something abstract that we could measure through movement. But what is it? So Maharal will tell us that time is the progression of change. Time is the progression of change. So again, unlike the physical model, where we don't see purpose necessarily. He would say that reality is in a state of constant change. Constant change. That the world is going, the world and the people in it are going somewhere. They're headed on a path. And we measure that path through its physical expression, which is actual physical time. So we now have two things. Spiritual time, which has to do with the constancy of the world and everything in it's moving towards the goal for which God created it. and we have the physical markers of time, days, months, years, minutes, whatever. And it's easy to confuse the two. There are people who are very diligent about marking off time. They'll have good watches, because it's very important to know if it's 6:01 plus 5 or 6:01 plus 4. Okay, they'll know when a leap year is coming. But the bottom line is they have no idea that it's going somewhere. They're clueless. Absolutely clueless. Judaically, we'll say that what time is about is giving us the way to measure things so that we can mark off our progress. I want to take this a step deeper before we go into the mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh. What does going further mean? So we spoke about having a relationship with God. In order for us to have some idea of who we mean when we say God, we use words like spiritual, transcendent, unlimited, eternal, unending. All of these tell us what God isn't, which is finite, but doesn't tell us what God is. The only way we ever know what anybody is through observing what they do and what they say. If I were to say Abraham Lincoln was an honest man, I would have to back it up with knowing what he actually said in the course of his life. So God makes himself known to us through his traits, through the 10 different ways through which he displayed something of his essential self, through what he does. So these traits, which are called sfirot, coming from the word sipur, the way God tells his own story, are alluded to at the very beginning of the Torah, where you have 10 statements through which Hashem created the world, 10 times where it says, let there be this, let there be that. Each one reveals something about the Creator, tells his story in a unique way. So these 10 traits, for us to get any sort of a grasp on them, are hinted at by the Kabbalists by using metaphors, because without metaphors, we're lost. So the metaphor they use most commonly is the metaphor of the human body. So for instance, kindness will be the right hand. Why the right hand? Because the hand expresses a person's will, and the right hand is the stronger of the two hands. So the 10 different sfirot are hinted at by 10 different parts of the body. But above it all, you have a state of being that's called the keter, or the crown. Picture a king wearing a crown. The crown is on the head, not in the head. So this would mean that above every way that we could possibly know God in our minds, there's super-rational knowledge as well. And this is hinted at, and this is the word they'll use, which is of course a metaphor, through the word keter, or crown. In Gematria, the Hebrew letter number system, the word keter has the same value as the word esrim, which is the number 20. What's that about? Now bear with me. What this is telling us is that there are 10 ways that we could observe God consciously, but there are another 10 that are beyond what we could observe. Now you could say, since this isn't Kabbalah 101, why am I telling you this? So the answer is this. We're supposed to have the real self that lives in this reality, right now, right here, that's making the best use of time. But we should also have the aspirational self, the self that sees beyond right now, the self that plans, who do I want to be in 5 years from now? Not what do I want to have, not where do I want to be, who do I want to be in 5 years from now? Where will I be going? Where am I taking myself? So that self, the aspirational self, can't be put down in physical terms, can it? So that self is the self of the second half of the keter. So let me give you an example of what I mean. A person may look at themselves today and say, I've moved in the last 5 years. I've come closer to observance, to tradition, more aware. But there are flaws. I want to move on, and 5 years from now I want more and I want better, qualitatively, quantitatively. So a person should see themselves flowering, moving from here to there, growing. So what does this have to do with Rosh Chodesh? What this has to do with Rosh Chodesh is Hashem said, sanctify time. This is the first mitzvah, the first commandments that the Jews were given as a group. Sanctify time. It's a huge statement. That means take time and make it lead you someplace beyond time, beyond where you are today. So this is right now, and this is also in the aspirational self. So now be a Jew in Egypt. You get up in the morning and you're still tired. And when you leave the house, all you have to look forward for the next, let's say, 12 hours, 16 hours, is futile, meaningless, back-breaking work. And when you come home, you're so exhausted you could barely keep your eyes open. Could you easily become a human mechanism in that state? Remarkably, the Jews didn't. They really didn't, which was certainly far from the plan that the Egyptians had. What happened to them in the course of this enormous suffering is that they decided that they would make something of themselves right here, right now, and they would have aspirations. Where do we see them making something of themselves in Egypt? So their commitment was to stay not Egyptian, not to change their language, not to change their names, not to change their clothing, all of which are superficial signs of wanting to be like people who had lived lives that were going somewhere. But arguably, the most striking thing they did was that they decided to continue having children. And it wasn't easy. Wasn't easy. The servitude lasted 86 years of the 210 years that they were there. It's a long time. The end of the servitude, where the decrees against the children were enacted, wasn't an easy time to have children. They decided to nonetheless, children who they had no future for, children who they could make no guarantees to, why would they want children? So the answer is they had aspirations. They were going to still leave a spiritual mark on this world. They were going to choose to believe. They were going to choose to hope. They were going to choose to have almost superhuman emotional capacity to rise against the tests that they were confronting day by day. It was a huge thing. And we all have that capacity. It's something inherent, which is why we all are commanded to sanctify time, the here and now, the actual reality that we live in, and the aspirational self. What keeps us from doing this, for the most part, is fear of failure that's always based on actual failure. So we stay stuck. I want to tell you a true story. One of the very interesting figures the 20th century was Masaryk, the leader of Czechoslovakia, who turned it into a relatively liberal democracy in a time when that wasn't quite the thing to do. And a true story, he was a very interesting person, a very noble person in the full sense of the word. He was once walking, and he saw someone drowning in the river that passed through the city in which he found himself. Couldn't go in to save him. The embankment was too high. It was too risky. But he saw the man could climb out if he really tried, but the man by this point, the drowning man, was panicked, and he was just like sinking deeper and deeper and deeper into his panic to the point that he was swallowing water, thrashing around. So Masaryk screamed, stop! Stop thrashing about! You could save yourself! First of all, just turn over and float a minute so you can get your breath. Then you could move yourself forward. You could get that rock over there. See that rock? Hold on to it. But the man was so frightened that he just got further into his panic, and he was going to die any second. Masaryk took out his pistol and he said, "Stop panicking and hold on to the rock." And you know what? The man was saved. The man was unwilling to face certain death. That scared him too much. Somehow drowning was less scary, less unknown than being shot. So why am I telling you this story, other than I personally find it a fascinating insight into Masaryk and into human nature? But the reason I'm telling you this story is that we have incredible resources that we just don't relate to. So Rosh Chodesh has to do with finding those resources, sanctifying our time. The actual ritual of Rosh Chodesh required that the Jews actually observe the passage of time using the moon as its base. So that means they were commanded to observe time through focusing on the moon rather than the sun, which is the luminary that, as you know, in the conventional calendar, time is marked off through the sun, not through the moon. The Jews are compared to the moon. The nations are compared to the sun, amongst other comparisons. So the obvious question is, what's the basis? Why are the Jews compared to the moon? Why are the nations compared to the sun? So the answer is that the moon goes through its own process of containment and rebirth, while the sun doesn't. It's either shining or it's not. So what that means is that we have a different relationship to, I'm sure you guessed it, to time. So for the nations of the world, when you study their histories, what you see is rise and fall. Nations rise, develop their cultures, and invariably fall. With the Jews, we don't see this. We see a cycle of rebirth, fading, and rebirth. So the question is, why? Why do the nations rise and fall? And why are we constantly reborn? So this takes us back to why we are here as a people. So again, the world needs interpretation. Otherwise, we're in the position, again, of being the OBT who's looking at the computer. God determined that this level of interpretation can't possibly take place through individuals. It has to take place through a people. The message that we have is that our relationship to God is like the relationship of the moon to its source of light, the sun. Our position is that we reflect God's light, and because of that, there are cycles of renewal and rebirth. So this continual focus on cycle of renewal and rebirth is part of everyone's life. We all have times in which we're in a state where we feel like everything is against us. We feel that we can't move. So this state is called katnus demochin, having a contracted mind. There are times when everything feels bigger than life. There are other times that are called times of godless demochin, times where your mind expands with you, where suddenly things that seemed ordinary yesterday are inspiring today, and where everything seems possible. So we tend to attribute these times to outside factors. I'm in a bad mood. Why am I in a bad mood? Because I didn't sleep enough. Why didn't I sleep enough? Because of this one or that one. I'm in a bad mood. Why am I in a bad mood? Because my employer is impossible. He's just so obnoxious and neurotic and difficult. So we blame others and we blame ourselves for our times of katnus. But the fact is that those times are just as much part of the cycle as the time of godless, of the time of expansion. So what that means is that in these times of godless demochen, what we're supposed to be doing is moving and flowing, but in the times of godless, we're supposed to be holding on, not despairing, and that's enough. So if we could just, at these times, create in our minds lines that we won't cross. No matter how I feel, there are things I don't do. I'll still daven every day, even if I don't feel spiritual. I'll still say Birkat HaMazon, even if I gulp down the food as though I was a sheep eating grass. I'll still act to people with decency and integrity, even if that's not what I'm getting back. Those times are just as important as the times in which you expand. So we tend to not realize this, and we tend to be unrealistic in our assessment of ourselves. So what we have to do is to look at the times of expansion and see them as not being more or less important than the times of contraction. So this is the lesson of the moon. The Jews were commanded to sanctify the moon. Say, this month is going to be the source of all future Rosh Chodeshim. The word Rosh Chodesh literally means the head of that which is new. Rosh is head. Chodesh comes from the same word as Chidush. So the idea is that every month draws down new spiritual force. This month, the month of Nisan, the month of liberation, is the head of all months, meaning what was achieved in Nisan, which was redefinition, is achievable every month in its own way. So the lesson of Rosh Chodesh is that we have to have goals, we have to have aspirations, we have to have expectations, every month in its own specific and individual way. And that this is the key of getting out of Mitzrayim. This is what we had to do in order to be able to be liberated. How so? The word Mitzrayim literally means narrow place. The narrowest way to look at things is to see time as leading nowhere. That's how the Egyptians saw time. Their holy book was the Book of the Dead. They saw absolutely no purpose in things. Their world was the world of imagery. Their world was the world of absence of God. So what we did is we moved ourselves from Mitzrayim, and the first step that we had to do, and obviously it was through God's giving us the miracles and the salvation that we needed to get out. But on our side, the first step was Rosh Chodesh, saying we could sanctify time. So what are the examples of sanctification of time? So there are three different sorts of time. There's ordinary weekday, Shabbos and holidays, and Rosh Chodesh, which defines all of them. In an ordinary weekday, how should you define time? You start off your day, you have your early morning schedule, you get up, take a shower, daven, and then you have to plan right then, how is the end of the day going to be more than its beginning? That's what a daily plan is about. A monthly plan. Every month has its own spiritual reality. This is what the holidays or lack of holidays in the months are about. You have to begin to start your month from here and have the plan of by the end of the month being here, being more. Shabbos is what frees us from all sorts of servitude. Okay, everything that was Mitzrayim, the narrow view of life, is something that we could let go of on Shabbos. We could let go of being part of the picture of, I have to do it because I have to do it, because if I don't do it, it won't be done on Shabbos. And see the purpose of things and where things came from. So again, ideally on Shabbos, you start Shabbos with candle lightings, Kabbalah Shabbos. And for some people, unfortunately, that's the high point. Ideally, that's the beginning of point. And by Shalosh Shuddos, you should be here. And this is the lesson of Rosh Chodesh. We begin when the moon is just starting its process of renewal. And our vision is that we're going to move, there's going to be more light, and it's going to come day by day progressively more. So everything about Rosh Chodesh is about all of the times that we celebrate, about Shabbos, about holidays, and about the ordinary weekday. The difference between Rosh Chodesh and Shabbos, and therefore all of the holidays, since the holidays revolve around Rosh Chodesh, if you decide that this is the first of Nisan, Pesach will be 14 days from there, is that humans have to take responsibility for it. Hashem imbued Shabbos with intrinsic Kedusha. That means whether you observe Shabbos or you don't observe Shabbos, there's still something inherent about what it is. Conversely, when you have Rosh Chodesh, if the earthly court in earlier times didn't actually go through the ritual where people would travel as soon as they saw the new moon, they would travel to offer testimony. There was a special place in Yerushalayim for this. And the laws concerning who could come were such, they had lavish meals for them to encourage people to come, so they wouldn't say, "Oh, somebody got here before me, what good was it?" They had a room with different ways the moon could look. Did it look like this? Did it look like that? Different ways of examining the witnesses. And finally, the religious court would say, "Mekudesh, Mekudesh, it's holy, it's sanctified." And they would arrange for people with flames, with torches, to make signs. They would raise the signs up and down, backwards and forwards. There were people waiting on all the mountaintops to see the flames from Har Zeitim. And before you knew it, they were on every mountaintop in Israel. There were flames announcing Rosh Chodesh all the way up till Syria. So what's this all about? This is about humans saying, "We've woke up." So we're answering Hashem. So we're not like people who say Hashem is talking and I'm not hearing. We're saying, "Yes, you've given us renewal. You've given us possibilities. You've given us chiddush." And this is what Rosh Chodesh is about. So we should have the merit of celebrating many Rosh Chodeshim with simcha.